This podcast is brought to you by the American Enterprise Institute.
If you like what you hear, please subscribe, rate, review, and share.
Thanks for listening. Here's our show.
What in the hell's going on?
What the hell is going on?
What the hell is going on?
I don't know what the hell he's talking about.
You don't have to know what the hell is on it.
What the hell's the matter with these guys?
We don't know what's going on.
What the hell's going on?
Who in God's name knows what it's all about?
Hi, I'm Danielle Pletka.
And I'm Mark Thiessen.
Welcome to our podcast, What the Hell is Going On? Mark, what the hell is going on?
Well, what the hell is going on is the Biden administration is telling the American people that Bidenomics is awesome and that they've got all the problems solved. Wages are rising. Inflation is coming down. The economy is better than you think it is, people. And Americans are saying, no, it's not. No, it's not. The polls show 57% of Americans think the economy is headed in the wrong direction. 43% say, a plurality, say that Biden's economic policies have personally hurt their bottom line. Only 18% say that his policies have helped. There seems to be a disconnect between the people in the White House and their economic message and the lived reality of the American people. And when your message directly contradicts the lived reality of the people you're talking to, they tend to not listen to you, and they tend to vote for the other guy. That seems to be where we're headed.
I have had this feeling more and more about this administration. In our interview, I ask our guest why it is that the Biden administration seems so weirdly out of touch. Like, you know, no, inflation's coming down, you stupid people. And it's like, dude, I know you don't go to the supermarket, but don't the people who work for you go to the supermarket? Because no one who goes to the supermarket feels that way. I said this yesterday, I think, or a couple days ago on Twitter. There was this big, huge announcement about how by some year within the next decade, the United States economy is going to move away from gas-powered automobiles. And it was just like, are you in an election year? Do you get out there at all? Do you see the uptake on electric cars cratering? Who are you pandering to? I don't get this administration. I feel like they're locked in the room with Claudine Gay from Harvard, and that's and that's it. Have I gotten my requisite Harvard insult yet in?
There you go. Absolutely. Every podcast. Yeah. And, you know, they're terrified about losing Michigan. And so they're pandering to the Arab Americans on the Israel war when they really ought to be more worried about the auto workers who they're screwing over with their EV policies, because that's a bigger threat to the elections in Michigan. So, I mean, there's the general political incompetence of the Biden administration driven by ideology. But I think one of the big problems they have, and I think you hit on this, is, you know, when you talk to our guest about, you know, what it's like to go to a grocery store, and the fact that these people go to the same grocery stores and they're paying the same prices and they're experiencing the same economic problems, but they're not reflecting that in what they say. I think that the disconnect can be explained in a pair of statistics entirely, which is when Joe Biden came into office, because of COVID spending, Americans had the highest rate of personal savings in the history of the country. And over the course of the last 3 years, we've gone from the highest personal savings rate to the highest rate of personal debt ever recorded. We just hit over $1 trillion in credit card debt for the first time in the history of our country. Personal debt of all kinds is at the highest levels it's ever been. And just 3 years ago, people were flush with cash. Why is that? It's because they had all this cash from the COVID spending, from the fact that they were locked in their homes and weren't able to spend their money. And then Biden kicked in this last tranche of COVID spending, $1.9 trillion in economic stimulus that unleashed the worst inflation in 40 years. And so to keep up with it, they had to spend down all of their savings. And then when their savings accounts were empty, they started spending up their credit card debt. And on top of that, Biden added in, we had to raise interest rates to slow down inflation. And so they're not only are their credit cards maxed out, but they're paying record interest on the debt. They can't pay off their credit cards. And so when Biden says inflation's going down, they're looking at it and saying, I've gone from a savings account full of money to maxing out my credit cards and paying this huge interest on it. And oh, by the way, because of interest, I can't buy a house. I can't afford my mortgage. And the disconnect is so huge. But that's the core of it, I think.
So I think this is actually a really interesting point, because you know, the Biden administration is making the same mistake that Hillary Clinton made, which is to denigrate the people who are considering voting for Donald Trump as deplorable, as insurrectionist, as, you know, the scum of the universe. And I'm sure some of them are, just like some of the people who are supporting Biden are indeed the scum of the universe. But I think that what people fail to understand is that among what, you know, people call low information voters, and let's face it, most voters in America are low information voters because they're not freaks like us. They're not paying attention to everything that Trump says or Biden says. They actually, you say Bidenomics to them and they're like, what are you talking about? Right? They're not paying attention day to day, but their lives that they live every single day suck worse now than they did 4 years ago. And that's why they're thinking of voting for Donald Trump. They don't give a damn about any of this other stuff.
They're high information voters when it comes to their pocketbooks.
Exactly.
Right? They're high information voters about what they're paying at the gas pump and the grocery right. store and what their credit card bill is this month.
Right. And telling them that they're stupid. No, no, you're stupid. You don't understand. You're making a shit ton more money. You should be happy with me. And the answer is, I will say this, and again, I, you know, economically one of the luckier people around, I used to drop eggs all the time, right? Because when you're cooking, you know, your hands are greasy, you've got butter in your hands, you're making stuff, and I used to drop them all the time because I'd drop them all the time, or I would mix the yolk in with the white and then you have to throw the thing out. And I used to think, oh, whatever, right? And now it's like,
an egg, it's not that expensive. How much does an egg cost, right? A lot.
But now I feel like, actually, this is expensive. I'm throwing away money here. And listen, if I'm thinking that, everybody's thinking that. And if you are the president of the United States, you do not want to say to people, you're stupid, that egg is worthless, you know, and you just are too dumb to understand what I've done for you, which has basically been the Biden administration's approach. I really don't get it.
So one thing, we don't talk politics with our guest. We talk economics, but let's talk politics here amongst ourselves for a second. The Democratic Party used to be the party of the working class, and they've lost the working class. The Republican Party has now been the party of the working class. So they've become the party of the coastal elites and a coalition of coastal elites and minorities mostly, right? And so they need super majorities of minority voters, and they need all their liberal friends in New York and San Francisco and Los Angeles and all that to get elected, right? What they are panicking about now is that their numbers with minorities are dropping dramatically. So it's not like the myth that Donald Trump's election and possible re-election is driven by angry white working class voters is actually not true.
It's driven by angry working class voters.
Of all colors. They have dropped 30 points over 3 years with black voters. Biden has dropped 17 points with Hispanic voters. And what the reality is that they are hurting those voters' pocketbooks with their policies. And so those voters are saying, well, okay, I'll vote for Trump. And so if they can't be the party of the working class anymore, and they can't be the party of the supermajority of minorities, they just become the party of the coastal elites, the people who are the most insulated from all these economic problems that they're unleashing on the rest of the country, who think the biggest problem in the country is climate change, and so we need to spend all this inflationary spending to get rid of the gas-powered cars that auto workers in Michigan produce. And let's make these much more expensive and much less labor-intensive electric cars that nobody wants to drive because that's saving the planet. And so, you know, their base is basically becoming the climate change cult of the liberal elites, and they're losing minorities, they're losing working class voters, and it's all driven by these bad economic policies.
That's true. And that's what we're here to talk about today. And we've got the best guest possible. Gary Cohn is the vice chairman of IBM and served as chief economic advisor and the 11th director of the National Economic Council in the Trump administration. Before he served the White House, Mr. Cohn was the president and chief operating officer of Goldman Sachs and a member of that firm's board of directors. He began his career, and I add this especially because of the conversation we have about trade and tariffs, began his career at U.S. Steel, which is super interesting.
And he's a really great explainer of economics to non-economists like you and me. So you will really enjoy this interview and get a lot out of it, because you don't need a PhD in economics to understand what's happening in your pocketbook. And thanks to Gary, you won't need one to understand what's happening in the overall economy. Here's our interview. Well, Gary, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
It's so great to have you. You're a remarkably good explainer of economics for people who are not economists like Danny and I and many of our listeners, though some of our listeners are. But the question that a lot of us are asking is, you know, President Biden has made a case that the economy is getting better, inflation is better than it was, that wages are up, that he's done a pretty good job, and he's getting very low ratings from the American people on the economy, and it seems like Americans don't feel the economy is better. What is the disconnect? Why are the economists saying that things are getting better and the people who are actually living the economy every day don't seem to feel that way?
Well, it's one of these answers where both things can be true in some regards. But let me try and explain what I think people are feeling. They are actually feeling this. When you talk about the economy, the number one thing that affects most people and their well-being is how well their standard of living is. And people measure their standard of living by how much purchasing power they have. They take their wages, and at the end of the week, what do their wages buy? And it's a basic school. Do my wages buy more this week, or do they buy less? And the two most important factors that people look at when they're looking at the purchasing power of their wages is food and energy. And so when you look at what's going on with the price of food, and that's very transparent because people buy relatively the same basket of groceries week after week, people have a pretty good idea, hey, my basket of groceries cost me $100 3 years ago. That same basket cost me $125 plus today. And by the way, that's the actual data. So the basket of groceries that cost you $100 3 years ago cost you over $125 today. So you're saying, look, I'm paying $25 plus more for my basket of groceries. My wages surely haven't gone up by that same percentage in that period of time. So even though I'm working just as hard as I was 3 years ago, I cannot purchase as much as I could 3 years ago. And that's a basic problem that the Democrats have in explaining, yes, the economy is doing fine. You know, last month we got to a point where inflation and wages were actually identical, so people stopped losing purchasing power. Some interesting data, if you want to look at this over certain cycles, you know, if you look at January 21st, which is inauguration, to January of 24, you know, CPI, which is Consumer Price Index, was up 17.9%, which is over 6% a year. If I add in February in there, it goes up to 18.83%, which is 6.27% on average. So, you know, the consumer has been paying over 6% a year more for their goods and services. And that's the issue that everyone's fighting with.
So can you explain one thing that you did brilliantly on Face the Nation recently, which is the fact that inflation has a compounding effect? Everyone says, oh, inflation's down now. Well, no, it's just down now, but it doesn't mean the prices have gone back to where they were 3 years ago. Can you walk us through that?
That's what I was trying to explain with the basket of groceries. The inflation calculation is one of the most interesting calculations we have, because most economic calculations, or most calculations we use in our everyday life, have some baseline. We compare it to some time in the past. The inflation calculation is not a baseline calculation. It's either a month over month number or a year over year number. So when someone quotes inflation to you and they say, oh, it's only 4.1%. Well, 4.1% over what it was 1 year ago. But 1 year ago, it was up 10%. So if you go back 2 years ago, it's 10 plus 4.1. So it's 14.1% for the 2 years. So you've got this compounding effect of inflation. That's how that $100 basket of groceries gets to be a $125 basket of groceries. And it keeps going up. So the problem is that until you have disinflation or negative inflation readings, the price of everything that you are buying, whether it be a good or a service, is going up month over month, year over year, and it continues to build or compound upon the last number we got.
So, Gary, I really appreciate the fact that you can explain this, because I think there's a lot of effort at the higher levels in federal government to bamboozle people. You know, no, 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 you don't believe your own eyes, listen to me. But, you know, we are not living anymore in the days of George H.W. Bush, who, if you remember, was stunned by the price of a gallon of milk and made himself look so out of touch. So these people remember that is like a political lesson. What I don't get is, I think I'm reasonably comfortable. And when I go to the supermarket, I realize that where I used to buy 10 things for $100, I now buy 5 things for $100. Why is it that the people who live in the same market I do, who work in the Biden administration, who understand the same things, who shop at the same supermarkets, who buy the same basics, are insisting to their voters something that isn't credible? This is where it's mysterious to me, because it seems so politically strange and counterintuitive, rather than saying, you know, we're working this, we're going to make everything different, and plus, you know, we're giving you better wages, yada, yada, yada. Why not do that? Do you have a theory of the case?
No, Danny, you're completely right. And this is why there's such a big disconnect between the Biden White House and the U.S. economy and the voters, and why the vast majority of voters polled today tell you the economy is still one of their top issues, and they're very disappointed by the U.S. economy. U.S. consumers are pretty smart. They're very smart. You know, they know what they spend each week for their groceries. They know when they stand outside their car and they hold the nozzle down and they fill up their tank of gas. They know what those numbers were last week, last month, and last year. So they know if that tank of gas was $78 last week and it's $80 this week, they know there's $2 difference. And they know that it was $60 last year. We remember those things. And then there's some real staples that have really gone through some price shocks that people really had to deal with, like eggs, for example. When we look at the price of eggs, people really watch that. The price of eggs has gone from somewhere like $1.50 a dozen to at one point we were close to $6 a dozen in the United States. Now, look, it's pure inflation. There were some extraneous factors, which, you know, because we had avian flu, we had to kill off some of the chickens, but it doesn't matter to the U.S. consumer how the price got there. All they know is they buy 3 dozen eggs every Monday and it keeps them through the week. And that $2 now became $6. So they're buying 3 dozen eggs for $6. Now they're spending $18. So all of a sudden they have 12 less dollars to spend on something else. So if you're a hardworking American, you're now making a decision. What am I not going to buy? Because I'm going to buy the 3 dozen eggs because my family needs 3 dozen eggs.
So this inflation is in many ways a bipartisan achievement in the sense that it was unleashed by COVID spending, and there was a lot of COVID spending in the end of the Trump administration. But then Biden came in and decided he wanted to be in on the game of having solved COVID. And so he did this massive COVID spending that even Democratic economists like Larry Summers were warning would unleash this inflation. How damaging was that last tranche of COVID spending to our economy? Was that a catastrophic mistake?
Yes. Plain and simply, it was a catastrophic mistake. The $1.9 trillion stimulus at the beginning of the Biden administration, when we were already coming out of COVID, when the economy was renormalizing, when the consumer was already in relatively to very good shape because they had taken their prior stimulus and they had used it to pay down debt. They had used it to build savings back. And we actually had a consumer in very good position. We did not need that extra $1.9 trillion stimulus package. And then look, it didn't stop there. Had it stopped there, it might have been okay. But like this idea that we're going to give consumers a lot of money and we're going to help stimulate the economy, we're going to increase the money supply. You know, we didn't stop there. Then we went to the Inflation Reduction Act or the Inflation Creation Act. So we then took trillions of dollars and then are putting that in the economy by creating infrastructure and building projects and stimulating more economic growth. Then we had the CHIPS Act, which, like, I am supportive of the CHIPS Act, but we can't deny that it's not stimulative to the U.S. economy. The Biden administration continues to find ways to put money back into consumers' pockets, cancellation of student debt. All of these things have the exact same effect. They have more dollars chasing a finite amount of goods. And they put the consumer potentially in a better place to spend money, even though they're spending money in an inflationary cycle, they're still creating more demand for goods.
This is a real snowball. What, for me, obviously, the price at the pump, the price at the supermarket are the things you see every day. But debt is something that, again, we are talking about such a massive, massive swing that happened. And again, I think most of us understand that during COVID, there was an artificial rise in American savings rates. And so it's not fair to say, ooh, habits were changed, everything was different. You know, if you lock someone in their house, guess what? They're going to save more money, unless they're me, and then there's online spending. But that's a different podcast. But the Federal Reserve Bank of New York reports, you know, regularly, you know better than we do, on debt. And the numbers just smacked me over the head. Total household debt increased by $212 billion in the fourth quarter of last year. Mortgage balances up by $112 billion from the previous quarter and stood at $12.25 trillion. Home equity lines, credit card balances, auto loan. People owe a ton of money. And if there's ever a monkey on your back, it's owing money. What's going to happen?
So, Dan, it's interesting because coming out of COVID, we were in the complete opposite side of this equation. We had created record high savings rates in the United States, and we had consumer debt at basically record lows because people had taken the stimulus checks that the government had given them, and they had used it to pay down deficit, and they'd used it to save. Because as you just rightfully pointed out, when you're locked in your house, A, the vast majority of expenses you have, whether it be commuting expense, car expenses, dry cleaning expenses, going out to lunch, buying lunch at work, all of those expenses that you have in your normal everyday activity of going to work disappeared. And the shopping that you would normally do, the only thing that was available was the grocery store or something that FedEx, UPS, or the United States Postal Service would bring to your front door. So your ability to consume was highly curtailed. So people were forced to save. Then when COVID ended, you rightfully pointed out, when we sort of allowed people to go out and re-engage in the economy, there was this massive pent-up demand for people to go out and spend money. And the American consumer, unfortunately, has been taught that you should, you know, live on credit. If you earn a dollar, go spend two. And that's unfortunately what's happened. So we went from, you know, really low consumer debt levels to we are right back to all-time record high consumer debt levels. So, you know, the consumer in this economy is feeling pinched because they have taken their credit cards. They've used their outstanding balances, their existing balances. They don't have a lot more room. They probably have no room left on their credit cards. Their savings have been dwindled down and interest rates are higher. So to the extent that they have anything that is being paid on a variable interest rate, which is most likely everyone does because if your consumers are carrying a balance, that balance is affected by the interest rate. And so your interest payments alone on your credit card balances go up month after month after month. So your purchasing power goes up. You can't even afford the interest. So your debt goes up and up. And add the last piece of this equation, because you talked about mortgages. For those Americans that were smart enough or were trying to really plan for their future, and they were trying to save money to put a down payment on a house, and they were looking what houses cost 2 years ago or 3 years ago, and they were looking what interest rates were, and they thought that they would be in a position, you know, by 2024 to be able to buy a house, that possibility has completely disappeared because housing prices have gone up in this inflationary cycle. But even more importantly than housing prices gone up, the cost of their mortgage has doubled. So their ability to service a mortgage doesn't exist today. So not only are people having a tough period right now in this existing environment where things are expensive, their ability to make a long-term investment in themselves and get a hedge against the economy by buying a piece of real estate is almost impossible right now with these very high mortgage rates. And I think it's going to stay very tough for the considerable future.
Right. And this all ends in tears. One of the most interesting statistics for me, it was really interesting at Christmas time. My daughters wanted a particular bathing suit and I couldn't find it anywhere. And I told them, I can't find this in the store. It's sold out. But I keep seeing it on the secondary market, you know, at Poshmark, on the RealReal. I said, that's so weird. You know, first of all, who buys bathing suits on the secondary market? Ick. But also why? And of course, they knew the answer. Oh, they said, that's because Klarna and all of these other borrowing things that are at the bottom of every single checkout now.
Buy now, pay later.
Buy now, pay later schemes encourage them to spend more money than they have. And then when they need to pay, they don't have the money, so they sell at a loss on the secondary market. Now, of course, no surprise to me then to see that while delinquencies have gone up at every age group, delinquencies have gone up among young people even more. But I mean, that screws you for the future. Your credit rating is down. You can't get a mortgage. You can't get a student loan. You can't buy a car. What does this say about the future of our society, that people are basically dealing themselves out of being able to advance themselves?
This is not a totally new phenomenon. Look, we've had credit cards for as long as I've been alive. The credit card industry, you know, had gotten smarter. It is now prospecting college-age kids. So they're on college campuses. So they're going after a younger and younger demographic. But as you point out, Danny, very astutely, is the new digital buy now, pay later companies have attacked all of the online shopping. So the online shopping, which is a different demographic, which is a much younger skewed demographic, it probably skews younger and more female. That's a guess. I'm going to guess it skews younger and female. They're now trying to get that demographic to extend credit to them. And because to them, it's a very profitable business to be the first in line to extend credit to somebody. So this is a old, true profession in the United States to get people hooked on credit. Once you own their credit profile, you're sort of in control. And unfortunately, it's a never-ending phenomena that once someone owes you money, you're just treading water or you're just climbing uphill all the time trying to service the debt because the interest itself just eats away at you. And so every time you get a little bit of it paid, they give you a little bit more purchasing power. You build a little bit better credit record, they give you a little bit more purchasing power. You just keep treading water, unfortunately. And it's a horrible position. You see it. As you point out, the data shows the consumer debt right now is at all-time record high. And you're right. It's in that younger, newer demographic. It's not the older population that's going out and shopping online and is finding these new online, I would say, debt creation services.
The problem, I guess, that the Biden administration has is that all their messages are contrary to the lived reality of Americans. I mean, the 43% plurality say Biden's policies have made their lives personally worse. Only 18% say better. And you've got these economic numbers. And I guess if you think about it from the perspective of a consumer, as you point out, you started the Biden administration with record savings, and then the last tranche of COVID spending came out and it unleashed this inflation. And as you spent down your savings to keep up with inflation, then you maxed out your credit cards to keep up with inflation. And now you're maxed out. And oh, by the way, you're paying this record interest because we had to raise interest rates to put a brake on the inflation. And now you're looking at that. Joe Biden's saying, yeah, but inflation's down. If you were advising them on what they should be saying, what should they be saying? Or is there just no communication solution to the economic mess we're in?
I would take the complete opposite approach. I'm a very much of a realist in this. I would say, look, we feel your pain. We understand that we've been through a highly inflationary cycle here. We are going to do everything we can, but then they'd have to do everything they could. We're going to do everything we can to lower the burden on you as hardworking Americans. We're going to help you with the price of things. And therefore, we as the government are going to find ways to make things cheaper. Now, look, that means in many respects, they've done some of these quietly. And the one thing is, they have tried to make sure that the price of oil has not gone up too much, because the worst inflation in the world, we alluded to a few minutes ago, is you standing out there holding the pump. because you know that number every day you fill your car. You know exactly what it should cost. So when that number goes up by $5 a week or $5 a month, that's totally horrible for the administration. So they've done everything they can. They released all the strategic fuel barrels. They've done everything they can in the oil market to try and keep the oil price down. So they need to continue to flood the market with energy, basically all energy, because it's not just gasoline, it's electricity. The price of electricity is going up, which is contrary to what they want to do. They want to determine what molecules of energy you can consume based on their pollutive powers or their lack of pollutive powers. In this inflationary cycle, you have to put everything on the table. You have to say, look, we're going to let you consume gas. We're going to let you consume oil. We're going to let you consume coal. We're going to have nuclear power plants run full out because we just need to flood the market and make energy cheap because energy is at the basis of everything we do. Then, you know, they've kept up with this high tariff policy. I have a view, and not everyone agrees with me, but what is a tariff? A tariff is a consumption tax. A tariff at the border is a consumption tax. So if we're importing something in the United States, the tariff's paid at the border, that tariff is passed directly on to the U.S. consumer in the form of a consumption tax or a price. Now, look, I'm pretty clear on this. If we manufacture something in the United States, and someone's dumping that product here because they have a much cheaper cost of labor because they don't pay a living wage and they don't have a cost of capital and they don't have to worry about the environment, we should not allow them to undersell our U.S. manufacturers. But if we don't manufacture it in the United States, which is the vast majority of things that we import in the United States, and our consumers really want to consume it, I don't know why we're putting a 20 or 30% tariff on at the border, which makes it 20 or 30% more expensive. If I were the Biden administration, I would say, you know what? We're going to suspend all tariffs on things that we don't make at the border right now. And that would lower the price of goods, especially, you know, the goods that we consume every day. We have no idea how many goods come in over the border every day that we don't make here. It's the vast majority of things that people buy at big box retail stores today. And they're not just cheap items. They're some of the most expensive items, from television sets, baby strollers, all the way down, you know, sort of the spectrum. I would find ways to say, we're going to try and relieve the burden from you as quickly as we can. And that's what I would do. That's really the only thing you can do right now. Look, I'll touch on another topic, but the whole immigration problem in the United States is also creating more demands for goods and services. And that's part of the definition of inflation. It's too many dollars or too many people chasing a finite amount of goods or a finite amount of services. So, you know, if you look at New York City today, in New York City today, the vast majority of low-end hotel rooms have been taken over by the city to house migrants. So if you're trying to travel to New York City and find a relatively cheap hotel room, they don't exist because the migrant population is living in those hotel rooms because the city has taken them over. And by the way, not only has the city taken them over, the city is feeding the migrant population. And so there's more demand for food. There's more demand for services. There's more demand for goods in the illegal migrant population, which has its own inflationary pressures here in the United States. So if we would curtail the illegal immigration and we would actually lower the price of goods by making them more readily available and not taxing things at the border for some period of time, I think that if I were trying to solve this problem, those are things that I would do, which would have pretty immediate effects.
And they can't work, most of them, so they're actually not helping address the labor shortage.
Exactly. So they're consuming and taking away, they're taking goods and services out of the economy, and therefore they're keeping the price high because, you know, there are a finite amount of hotel rooms. There's a finite amount of food that gets imported. There's a finite amount of food that gets created every day.
I mean, it's interesting that you talk about the tariffs, though, because, I mean, one of the things we confronted both in the race, the first race of Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump, and certainly every race since then, is that we do not have a political party that supports freer trade any longer in the United States of America. There is nobody other than Gary Cohn on this podcast. There are very few people who are advocating for freer trade and for lower tariffs, and certainly very, very few in government. So we're not seeing any pressure coming from Capitol Hill on this. We're not seeing any pressure coming even from inside the Fed. I mean, this is the problem of ideology.
The Fed's not going to get involved in this. The Fed won't get involved in this policy. It is surprising to me that as people sit there and wring their hands on getting inflation down, and what we found is the last mile or getting down from 3% to 2% is hard, why we're not throwing sort of more things at the problem. And so what are those last things? Freer trade clearly would be one of those solutions that I would look at. But look, I'm clearly a free trader, and I think I'm a dying animal in the United States.
You are, and I'm a free trader, and I think Mark's certainly a pretty free trader. And yes, so we've gathered here for our annual meeting in a closet.
I was going to say, we've had an annual meeting of the free traders.
Exactly. I want to follow up about this question of Bidenomics and what its consequences are. It's been actually really interesting. I'm willing to bet you are among those who have sort of watched The Economist magazine for the last 30, 40 years. It has drifted in a particular direction. And there was a piece that was entitled, "What Four More Years of Joe Biden Would Mean for the American Economy." It then listed the pillars of Bidenomics: support for workers via unions, more social spending, tougher, quote unquote, competition policy, unquote, green investment, and higher taxes on large firms and the wealthy. Now, of course, they then put a picture of this next to it, and what do? They put a picture of the federal debt as a percentage of GDP. You know, for me, this is so retrograde. This is so economically dangerous. I suspect that there's some backstory here that The Economist is trying to tell. But I mean, what happens? What do four more years of Bidenomics mean?
They sort of hit the nail on the head, right? I don't think the next four is going to be any different. I think that's the definition of insanity, doing something and expecting a different result. So I think that this social spending will be there. The competition will be there. And by the way, instead of going through that list, the great irony of it is everything on that list, except for raising taxes, is highly inflationary. That's the funny thing about it. Everything on that list is highly, highly inflationary. This anti-business, this anti-corporation, you know, going after companies for no reason whatsoever, outsourcing our regulation to Europe and making Europe opine on mergers that they know will go through and they can't stop them. This is a crime in itself. You know, the social programs, to me, it's socialism. It's redistribution of income. What they want to do is they want to redistribute income. And, you know, I think a lot of this revolves around this fallacy of taxation in the United States. And I'd love to spend a minute talking about it because I think people don't understand this. There's this trope that, you know, the rich don't pay, the rich need to pay their fair share, billionaires don't pay taxes in the United States. It's just not true. So the data is the bottom 50% of taxpayers in the United States pay 2.3% of all taxes collected. In effect, the bottom 25% have a negative tax rate. They don't pay taxes. They get money back from the federal government. So we're the top 1% of all earners pay 42.3% of all taxes collected. Top 5% pay 62.7%. And the top 10% pay 73.7%. So top 10 pays basically 3/4 of all the tax dollars that are collected in the United States. And those tax dollars have gone up and gone up quite dramatically over the last few years. So this idea that we're just going to continue to tax the rich, like we do tax the rich. We are as progressive as a tax system as you're going to find anywhere in the world. And the other great mantra is that, you know, the Biden administration talks about how they want millionaires and billionaires. Well, I think it moved to billionaires now since Biden is a millionaire. They want billionaires to pay the same tax rate that teachers pay. Well, I think the problem with their argument is they conflate net worth. Net worth is how much you're worth, with taxable income. And taxable income is what you pay taxes on. We don't have a wealth tax in the United States, although they'd like to have a wealth tax. We don't have a wealth tax right now. And outside of tax-free municipal bonds, There's no income in the United States, I don't care who you are or where you live, that doesn't have a tax rate of 20%. If it's qualified dividends, if it's long-term capital gains, any of those things that billionaires have, they're paying at least 20% on that income. So this idea that the billionaires are paying, you know, single-digit tax rates, I'd like to know how they're doing that, because it's not possible.
But this is Warren Buffett's argument. I mean, Warren Buffett really popularized this when he said, you know, I'm paying less in taxes as a percentage than my secretary.
All right, I'm going to call out Warren Buffett.
Please.
Well, Warren Buffett, if you want to pay more taxes, pay yourself a salary. Warren Buffett takes zero salary. Warren Buffett only owns stock in Berkshire Hathaway. Warren Buffett gets dividend income only, probably in the billions of dollars, so he pays a 20% rate on his dividends. And he probably pays his secretary very well, so she probably pays a 34% rate on ordinary earned income. So Warren Buffett, you could fix this. Why don't you pay yourself $1 billion a year salary?
Well, we've solved Warren Buffett's problem, but now let's solve America's. Is this a fair way to look at this? You've laid out in a really compelling way how it's not just the initial tranche of COVID spending that's inflationary. It's all the things they've done since, and it's all the things they're proposing to do in a second term. So we are continuously putting our foot on the gas of inflation, but we are simultaneously raising interest rates to put our foot on the brake. And so we are driving the car with our foot on the gas and our foot on the brake at the same time. As I understand it, cars don't work that way in the long run, and eventually the car will break apart. How sustainable is that as a long-term policy, to be driving with the foot on the brake and the foot on the gas at the same time?
So I'm not a race car driver, but I think that's the way you do donuts.
So we're in an economic donut.
Yeah, you put your foot on the brake and the gas simultaneously. Yeah. So it's the exact same thing. You're going in high-speed circles and making lots of smoke and burning out your tires. That's exactly what we're doing. Is the Fed can control interest rates, and they can try and slow down economic growth. They can try and create more unemployment, which is what they're trying to do by slowing down economic growth. But if the federal government is going to outstimulate the negative consequences of higher interest rates, we're spinning around in circles and creating smoke.
I want to ask you one last thing, and I know the actual name of our podcast is not What the Hell is Going On. The actual name of our podcast is We're Really Sorry We Kept You for Longer Than We Promised. I don't know if it would sell either, but yeah,
marketing
right.
Genius.
It's the ultimate.
Now you can name it to the Free Traders Convention.
Yes, exactly. That's right. It's just us three. I want to ask you about wages, because we haven't talked about that a lot. And that is a big part of this. One of the reasons why some people claim that inflation is obviously so devastating to people is because wages, quote, haven't kept up, right? Biden says that wages are up after being adjusted for inflation, but in fact, hourly wages are down. On the other hand, there are localities that are raising wages to like $15, $16 an hour. And of course, people being fired left, right, and center, as always happens when that happens. How do we solve the wage conundrum?
You're not going to solve the wage conundrum when you're running, you know, sort of 6%+ annualized inflation. Companies can't afford to raise wages 6%. And by the way, here's the conundrum. As you raise the wages, they have to transfer through the economy into the cost of goods sold. So one of the issues going on, and one of the reasons I think that inflation has been stickier in the first half of this year, is 22 states on January 1st of this year raised their minimum wage, which I don't think people were thinking about. But when you raise your minimum wage in 22 states, and some states like California raised it a lot, so all of a sudden the prices at fast food restaurants have to go up dramatically to cover the cost of those wage increases, is highly inflationary. So this wage price inflation has to go through the economy. As companies raise wages, they have to raise the price of their goods or services. So if we're going to get inflation to come down, you can't expect wages to go up and the prices of goods to go down. That can't happen. This idea, and this is another one of these interesting Bidenomic ideas, we're going to force companies to earn less money. It's just not going to happen. And I don't mean it meanly. Companies don't make as much money as perceived in the world today. So if you're forcing my wages up 5% and I'm operating at a, let's take easy numbers, I'm operating at 10% margin and I've got 50% wages, you're cutting my margin by 25%. So all of a sudden I had earned 25% less money just because the increase in wages. I have to raise the cost of my products to maintain my earnings ratio. So I sort of laugh at these junk fees. So, you know, Biden talks about cutting $20 billion of junk fees out. What I'm really concerned about is, okay, you took $20 billion of junk fees out. Do you think the financial service industry is going to just say, okay, we can live without those $20 billion of fees? They were just extra. We didn't really need to make those. It's not the way it works. You know, these are companies that, you know, in good times do well. In bad times, they sometimes don't survive. In fact, you know, we've seen banks have to be bailed out last week and the week before. And a year ago, we went through Silicon Valley and Signature Bank. These are industries where you're only as good as your last credit decision. And, you know, the regulators are always telling you to build more capital. So if you're going to take $20 billion of revenue out of these banks, you're going to have to find somewhere else to make that revenue up. And so the easiest place to make that revenue up, if you're a financial institution, is to cut down on credit losses. How do you cut down on credit losses? You pull back credit lending from the higher risk credits, which is the lower end borrower, which is the hardest working individual you probably have in your credit stack. So that, again, slows down the economy. It provides less credit to hardworking men and women. But it makes the bank safer and sounder, and it will protect those losses. So instead of getting the money through junk fees and extending credit, they'll stop getting the junk fees and they won't lose the money in credit. And it's really detrimental to the economy. So they think of how they can create a headline on junk fees. They don't think of the bad economic impact it's going to have. And a couple of years from now, they're going to be complaining how banks just cut credit to like the bottom 5% of borrowers. And the banks are going, yeah, I did it in response to what you did.
So exit question for me. We've got an election coming up and a lot of people are looking. Donald Trump is going to be the Republican nominee. You served in the Trump administration. A lot of people are looking and saying, you know, before COVID, I was doing great. And I think it's one of the reasons why he's surging in the polls is that the things they don't think they're doing great under Biden, they think Biden's policies have hurt them. I think right before the election, 56% of Americans in the Gallup poll said, I'm better off now than I was 4 years ago. And that was in the middle of the worst economic crisis in American history since the Great Depression, racial unrest, pandemic, and all the rest of it. What do you see as a potential Trump administration solution to all these problems? Because he's going to inherit this mess if he wins. He just said the other day that he's going to put 100% tariff on Chinese EVs coming through Mexico. You know, what would you be advising him to do to fix these solutions if we had a Republican administration and a Republican Congress that could pass some things?
So look, I think the election comes down to geopolitics and then it comes down to economy. Those are the two things I think. As Bill Clinton once said, it's the economy, stupid. So let's really talk about what matters here. So we touched on energy policy. I think we know what the Trump administration will do in energy policy. You know, I think the Trump administration is pretty clear that they are going to, you know, they are going to produce as much hydrocarbon as they can in the United States. They will allow fracking. They will, you know, encourage energy production all over, where I think the last 4 years has more been, I'll give you tax incentives to buy what I want you to buy, not what you really want to buy. So I think we'll go back to an open and free market in sort of the energy market and the automobile market. Obviously, immigration is going to be a huge topic. I think it's pretty clear where the Trump administration is going to go. It's pretty clear where they were, you know, 4 years ago. You know, and this immigration topic has all of these trickle-on topics that we talked about. We talked about how the immigrants are coming in, they're taking over resources, they're occupying hotel rooms, they're driving the cost of everything up in the United States. You know, that's important. Tax. You know, one thing that we can't underestimate, the Tax Reform Act that we got done in 2017, the personal side expires at the end of 2025. And it does expire. So you go into 2026 and you're back to the very, very complicated tax system that we had in 2017, much higher rates, a lot more complexity, all the crazy loopholes and deductions come back, things like the alternative minimum tax come back, all the state and local tax deductions come back. As I said, it's higher rates, but for people in high tax states, it's probably lower taxes for them. So even though it's higher rates, it's lower taxes. This whole position on regulatory being anti-business and anti-competition and overly regulatory to the U.S. corporate business, you know, what the Biden administration's doing, and they don't sort of understand it, is they're discouraging people from investing in the United States because the regulatory environment is so difficult that you'd rather just, you know, make the investment in another country where you know you can invest, you know you can hire people, you know you can work. You know, the M&A market here is tough. The capital markets are tough here. You can't take companies public. And I just think that the Trump administration will bring those things back to a normalized environment that, you know, is much more business friendly. And when the environment gets more friendly, companies will invest, they'll hire people, and the economy will tend to grow. And I think some of these other things on border and climate will be less inflationary, and surety of the tax code will clearly give people confidence.
Sounds good to me.
And on that optimistic note, well, there's a lot of baggage that comes with that, Mark Thiessen. But yeah, the economic part of that sounds good to me too. Gary, you've been amazing. Thank you. We're so grateful. You really explain things clearly, and I think in a way that reflects good principles, which is what we love. So thank you for joining us. I hope you'll come back.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
So Gary laid out a pretty good economic policy for the Trump administration. Danny, are you convinced?
If Gary were running for president, I would be. Otherwise, no sale, dude.
For other reasons than the economy.
For other reasons than the economy, and the economy isn't going to sell me. Other voters may feel differently, and that's fine for them. They may, and that's their choice. And obviously, in our democracy, I respect that. But geez, as everybody knows, but I'll say it again, just like Harvard, I wish we had better choices. I wish we had better choices, by the way, that weren't so old, which really is worrisome. But look, can I talk about something for a sec that really stuck with me? You know, not to say something that sounds like, you know, out of a Disney movie or a Miss America speech, but our young people are actually the foundation of our future. And the fact that they owe so much money that they are entrapped in this debt, that they don't understand how to spend within their means, is incomprehensible to me.
We've done a terrible job raising Gen Z. I just think we have, as parents. I mean, you know, we like to sit here and like a bunch of boomers. Oh, we're not boomers. We're Gen X. And
no,
you know,
I'm
complain
not.
About
I'm a
complain.
Boomer.
Oh, you're a boomer. Oh, that's right. You're older than me. I forgot. Thank you for reminding
me
that you're older than me.
Shut up.
But you know, we sit here and say, oh my gosh, kids today, you know, and with their social media and their, you know, bad work ethic and all the rest of it, and they don't know history and their scores are terrible and all the rest of it, and their work ethic is terrible, and it's on us. You know, I think we've done a pretty good job with our kids. I know your kids and you know mine, but as a generation, we've done a terrible job raising these kids. And what's stunning to me is that for all the problems that Gary just laid out, if you had a choice to be born at any time in history, from the dawn of the agricultural age 30,000 years ago to today, and you didn't choose today, you'd be absolutely nuts. You know, we're the most freest country in the world, despite our bad choices. We're the most prosperous country in the history of the world. I've mentioned this before, but there was a Brookings study that 5 years ago, for the first time in human history, more people were rich or middle class than were poor or on the verge of poverty. So we have a middle class majority across the world, not just in the United States. We have more cures for disease. On any metric, you want to live now. And yet, they're more depressed, more anxious, more worried, more upset at the world, angry at their situation than any generation. And I guess, you know, maybe binge spending on the web is a way to solve that. That's on us collectively to some extent.
It is, but it's something that we should talk about and think about more, because It is a failure. I agree.
And they don't know history. Levels of patriotism among young people are at an all-time low. You know, we talked in our last podcast with Nat Malkus about the scores on math and reading are terrible. The scores on history and civics are worse.
Yeah.
You know?
No, it's true. We're doing everybody a discredit. And I will say, and that's another thing. I read that list of the core elements of Bidenomics and that line about how we should be moving more American workers back into unions. And I thought, if they look like the teachers' unions, count me out. Never, never, never. Those are the people who are making our students dumb. Those are the people in whom we are reposing trust for our future generations, and they are letting us down. You know, there are wonderful teachers out there, but they are not the majority.
Yeah. The solutions, too, for young people are real simple. Don't get into debt. Work hard. Earn your success. Have a bunch of kids. One of the biggest problems is they don't like their economic situation and they want socialism, but they're not producing the taxpayers to pay for it. if you think you're economically unstable, then you have fewer kids. No, have more kids. In the old days, it used to be if your economic situation is unstable, you had 14 kids so you could put them in the field to work. You know, put them out in the economy to work and support you. You know, you have more kids. They're doing everything wrong, and it's our fault, Danny.
I think we just narrowed our listeners' demographic by a good 20%. But hey, kids, also get the hell off our lawn. Mark and I have a gun. Anyway, everyone, thanks a ton. Don't hesitate to reach out and let us know what you think. Kids, don't hesitate to let us know if we're wrong. Oh, everybody, this is Clara's last week as our producer. And just a last word of great thanks to her for being so patient, so good, for covering up all of Mark's mistakes, and of course, none of mine, and for being endlessly patient with us in everything that we do at AEI. We are going to miss you so much.
Absolutely. I agree 100%. And on top of that, she helped turn around the entire debate on Ukraine on Capitol Hill with her research on the Ukraine defense industrial base. So she's not only a great producer, she's a great researcher and has made a massive impact on public policy in a very small amount of time in Washington.
Godspeed, Clara.
Take care. See you all next week. Let us know what topics you'd like us to cover. You can get in touch with the show by emailing us at whatthehell@aei.org.
Or you can reach us on Twitter. I'm at D. Pletka.
And I'm at Mark Thiessen. That's Mark with a C.
Please rate and review the podcast. If you like the show, please subscribe, share it, comment on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you're listening to this.
Thanks for listening.